So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me from New York is Dorian Benkoil, standing in for Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Dorian?
I'm great, thank you. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing great. So Dorian, for those who don't know, is the sales and marketing manager for Media Shift and also our business columnist. And so he always takes kind of a good, interesting business angle that you don't always get from most journalists.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that. Yeah, I mean, I've always been kind of a glass half full, as much of a glass half empty person. And there's both positive and negative stories, but I definitely do try to see the positive when it's there.
Right. And with all the disruption going on in journalism and media, you know, it's easy to kind of say the sky is falling and everything's horrible and, you know, there's so much bad going on and people are being laid off. But, you know, there is also the stories, the good stories and the stories of the people who are innovating and doing new things.
Oh, unbelievable opportunity. It's a huge opportunity. I'm amazed constantly at the abilities of people to regenerate themselves and generate ideas and all the kind of entrepreneurial stuff that's going on.
No question. So anyway, you know, Rafat is off getting married and traveling to India and having his honeymoon. So, you know, we wish him well on his journey. But in the meantime, Dorian will be stepping in and helping out on the podcast. And then we'll also have some others coming in as co-hosts over the next couple months while Rafat is off on his long and winding road. So,
speaking of successful entrepreneurs,
exactly. So here's kind of the rundown of what we'll be talking about on today's show. We'll be talking a lot at the beginning about Apple and how it just had this incredible earnings report recently for the last quarter, $46 billion in revenue, net profit of $13 billion. We'll get into just these amazing numbers. Now the most the highest valued company in the world, surpassing Exxon. So we'll talk about Apple and just the juggernaut that it's become, and you know, see if we can find some weaknesses at Apple. And then second, we'll talk about how to get more clicks on your tweets, and we'll have a special guest, Dan Zarella. We'll talk about all the science he's put into Twitter and how you can promote better on Twitter, something that a lot of people, a lot of journalists, a lot of publishers think about more and more. And then finally, we'll talk about one of Dorian's subjects, which is the East Coast versus West Coast kind of rivalry that's happening now in media technology, where New York is kind of trying to become a little bit more of a tech hub, especially when it comes to media and technology, with more jobs being added and now this new high-tech center that's coming from Cornell. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, let's start with Apple, which just had, you know, first, it kind of missed its earnings a little bit in the third quarter, and then in the fourth quarter, it just had this just incredible blowout, where, you know, you can look at the numbers and just it's staggering, it's mind blowing, it's incredible. You know, you run out of adjectives really for how amazing it is. The unofficial Apple weblog had a few kind of interesting numbers, such as the iPad, just the iPad in one quarter brought in more revenue than 230 out of the Fortune 500 companies earned in an entire year. And the iPhone by itself in 3 months brought in more revenue than McDonald's made in all of 2010. And adjusting for inflation, Apple is a little over halfway to being able to finance its own version of the Apollo program all by itself. So Apple could set up space stations and start sending people to the moon. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Well, there's a great and funny Tumblr called Things Apple Is Worth More Than. So if you just search Things Apple Is Worth More Than .tumblr.com, you'll see, you know, it's worth more than the entire coffee industry. You know, as you said, it's worth a big part of the space program. And, you know, it's got all kinds of other funny examples.
Yeah, and, you know, now it has, what, $97 billion in cash. on hand, and they're putting tons of money. Some of the other numbers that this story had was that they put almost in a quarter, they put, I think it was like $750 million into R&D, which is just incredible. And you just wonder what's going to happen to all that cash. I mean, yes, there's going to be dividends, and the shareholders should get something for that. But Apple isn't the kind of company that's going to go out and buy Facebook or buy another company or try. That they usually buy smaller startups. So you wonder what's going to happen to all that cash.
It's funny that it's for people who don't follow business, I assume even people who don't follow business can see what a huge business story this is, let alone a story for the IT industry. I mean, they're even more superlatives. That the Apple's profit was worth more than the entire revenue of Google for that quarter. They sold, they're now the top IT company. They bested Samsung, and they have effects, ripple effects across the industry. AT&T has its earnings eaten into because Apple sells so many iPhones through AT&T that AT&T has to spend more money to support that infrastructure, and so they don't make as much money. I mean, it's got a huge footprint, and as they compete with others and have this huge amount of cash to spend, they can take steps, but as you say, they're so focused. I mean, one of the knocks on Amazon and Google in the last quarter has been that both of them are just spending a lot of money to buy things and acquire things and try things, and they don't have so much cash, and their earnings probably, well, Google's earnings were below expectations about a week and a half ago, and Amazon's are going to be released on Monday, and we may see that their earnings are low because they've been spending so much money on these things that have yet to make any profit. Like, they've been buying content and paying, paying money for rights for their streaming service and supporting a new publishing imprint and other things. And so I think we're just going to see this amazing competition between these companies trying to make money off of these things they've spent money on, as Apple sits on its pile of cash and can spend it on whatever it wants, which remains to be seen.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that's one thing that you have to give Steve Jobs a lot of credit for, which is that, he was all about focus. He was all about, let's keep it very, very simple. There's a lot of things Apple could do, but his big mantra was, let's eliminate things. Whether it was the design, making everything simple, or the product line, keeping it very just focused, and let's not go into areas that we don't quite have down yet. Let's not enter something new until we really know it and we really understand it. And that's something that very few companies can do.
Yeah, they're incredibly focused. I mean, of course, they could spend a lot of the cash on this new, spaceship-like headquarters that they had approved in Cupertino, California.
That's right.
So maybe that'll be the first multi-acre complex ever paid for out of pocket, but. That was an attempt at a joke, but I don't
Right.
think they'll
Well,
do
maybe they'll end up sending out spaceships from that place. I
If
mean.
you've seen the artist mock-ups, it looks like that. And the thing that's incredible, I mean, you alluded to it. I mean, Steve Jobs kept the company so focused, and they do things that are sort of against the current zeitgeist of what a tech company is supposed to do, right? They have kind of a closed system. They don't have open systems. You have to do things their way to write for the iPhone or the iPad or whatever. They have big profit margin per item, like their iPad and their iPhone and their Mac computers all are high margin items. So it's not the typical tech model these days of sell information at a slim profit margin over a wide scale. They're a manufacturing company. And, so they do all these things that are, Apple, and Apple does it its way, and it's been very successful doing so.
Yeah, and I mean, so while we want to be super, like you were saying, the half glass full, there's a lot. It's more than half full. This glass is probably overflowing. But as journalists and analysts, we can't help but think, well, there's got to be something wrong. There's got to be some issues at Apple. There's got to be some downsides. I mean, you look at the iPod sales. I mean, obviously now with iPhones, iPods are kind of the thing that's being outmoded a little bit. I mean, Apple was not afraid to kind of cannibalize its own older product lines.
Right. I mean, that's and also I think some people are ignoring the fact that there were some things that came together. It's not just that Apple's amazing. There were some things that came together in the last quarter that helped their sales. I mean, I hate to say this, and I don't mean this cynically, but the death of Steve Jobs and perhaps the biography written about him did probably cause more people to turn attention to Apple and got more attention to them.
Right, and the other thing that's really been eye-opening is there's been a series this week in the New York Times about the working conditions in the factories that are creating iPads and iPhones, and just, this is a long-running problem that Apple has been trying to fix with Foxconn and all these, places where they have underage workers, they have workers who are doing, 12-hour shifts, double shifts. Their legs are swollen from being standing in place for long periods of time. I mean, it's really kind of sad when you read the details of what goes on. And this isn't just Apple. This is the entire tech industry is having issues with the suppliers.
Yeah, it's a horrible that New York Times story was very difficult to read. I mean, the people, maimed in explosions and all kinds of horrible health issues and yeah, I mean the you know it's a it's you know I guess one hopes that as those economies develop and more attention is turned on them that the plight of the workers is addressed and they are required to treat their workers better, even if it means slimmer profit margins or a little bit of a dent in the cash flow. It's just people do not deserve to be working in those kinds of conditions, and I've witnessed some of that myself, having worked in China as a reporter. I haven't seen anything as horrible as what's described in that New York Times story, but it can be very disturbing, and you can see a great factory next to a really gruesome one. And you see that it is possible to make a profit even with good conditions.
Yeah, it is. And hopefully this kind of story and these kind of reports will just help kind of shine a light on it and hopefully make some change at Apple and some other companies, and maybe people will just start demanding, what some people are calling kind of fair trade electronics, where, the electronics are being created in better conditions and, under better circumstances.
I certainly hope so, yeah.
So up next, we'll talk to Dan Zarella and get his take on Twitter and using Twitter to kind of promote your stories as a publisher's. We as journalists have been using Twitter for years to promote our content and putting links to our content, but we really don't know, how to get people to kind of click through. I mean, obviously we can write headlines and things that are catchy, and we can put content on Twitter that we think, people and our followers are going to care about. But, how do we actually get click-throughs? Dan has actually done a lot to put some science behind what we think about using Twitter as for promotion. So let's add Dan to the conversation. So Dan Zarella is HubSpot's social media scientist and author of Zarella's Hierarchy of Contagiousness. He has a background in web development and combines his programming capabilities with a passion for social marketing to study social media behavior from a data-backed position and teach marketers scientifically grounded best practices. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, how does someone become a social media scientist? What does it take? Do you need a degree in this, or is it something you've kind of created on your own?
So this is something I've essentially created on my own out of what I saw as a need in the space. And so I had been, working in online marketing and then social media marketing when it started to happen, say, 4 or 5 years ago. And I started going to a lot of conferences, reading all the books and the blogs and all this kind of stuff. And I started to notice that there was a preponderance of, and I call it unicorns and rainbows advice, right? So stuff like, engage in the conversation and love your followers and stuff like that. And it's hard to disagree with because, I'm not going to tell people to punch customers in the face or anything, but it's generally not but it's generally not based on anything more substantial than just what feels right or what should, you know, what's truthy, to borrow Stephen Colbert's phrase, you know. And as a more analytical, as a, I'm a geek, right? I'm a geek to my core. I have a PHP tattoo on my shoulder, right? As a geek and as a person who's interested in you know, business and actually making money, it seems weird to me to leave business decisions to essentially truthiness, right? And to that unicorns and rainbows myth. So I started basically collecting data probably 4 years ago or so now, maybe a little bit more, about social media, about how people behave, you know, in social media, and then creating sort of proscriptive statistics for marketers to be able to follow.
And, you know, what how have people reacted to what you've done? I mean, it seems like there, I agree with you. I mean, it seems like there's so many people telling you this is what you need to do, these are the best practices for social media, et cetera. But you seem like one person who's kind of saying, well, wait, here are actual numbers. Here are things that, yeah, you know, I've actually found.
So I think there's a variety of responses that I get. I mean, clearly the unicorns and rainbows folks don't like it at all. You know, and I, honestly, I, you know, a lot of those folks, and I don't want to get into naming names and being mean, but a lot of the folks, honestly, when I was kind of coming up in the space, I looked up to them, and they're great people. I know them personally, but you know, they've made a name and they make a lot of money telling you to essentially engage in the conversation, and that's it, right? And they sell a lot of books doing that. So there's that crowd, right? And for the most part, they pretty much embraced what I've been saying, you know, because to do otherwise, I think would be tough for them. And then I get a lot of people who love just the stuff that I'm doing, and I find often smaller business folks who are, you know, maybe mom and pop shop just getting on the web, you know, they're really not interested in the unicorns and rainbow stuff because, you know, they're paying their bills based on how their business is doing this month. And if I'm telling them, you know, here's real data about how to do better, you know, they love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was really fascinated, Dan, that you were able to, I mean, first off, let me say that, you know, I confront exactly what you're talking about because Mark and I have, you know, hired a number of social media managers, and we've had great people recently who are able to both handle the unicorn and rainbow type of stuff and being held to numerical metrics. But, you know, we have in the past sometimes had a little bit of difficulty where we've had to say to somebody, well, yes, unicorn and rainbows, but we need to measure your performance, and how are we going to do that? And
yeah,
I was fascinated by this post you have on your danzarella.com where you talk about getting more clicks, and you were incredibly specific about, you know, 120 to 130 characters, for example. Do you know why that is? Like, why should you use that number instead of 80 characters or 140 characters in your tweet?
So I can get into that. The one thing that I do want to caveat with, and I think this is really important, especially when I start talking about the more specific recommendations that I make, my data is based in aggregates across multiple industries, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of tweets in that case. In some of my other research, it's millions or even billions of bits of information. So my data is produced as a starting point best practice. Think about like medical research, right? Researchers do tests on hundreds of subjects, thousands of subjects, but then in individual cases, doctors start with those results. And if it works in their case, great, that's what they stick with. If it doesn't, they try the next thing and they experiment. So for marketers, you know, don't take my data as, you know, the Bible. Just take it as, here's an interesting starting point, a way I may not have been thinking about it previously. Let me experiment with it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, let's try something a little bit different, right? And so the reason I'm able to get so specific is, like I said, because the data sets are so large that I'm able to find sort of statistically significant ranges in there. And where in that case, it's 120 to 130, I think is what I said. And I think the reason for that one specifically is that I have a TweetDeck monitor. So right now on my desk, you know, I have a home office. Right now on my desk, I have four monitors set up, right? One of them is just for TweetDeck. So it's legitimately an entire, I mean, it's a smallish monitor. It's not one of the 23-inch monitors, but it's a whole TweetDeck monitor. And there's hundreds and thousands. I follow 8,000 people on Twitter. There's a lot of tweets going through that monitor constantly, right? And if you take up more space with text, it's just more real estate to catch my eye, right? It's just bigger and louder, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be part of the reason why that, you know, the longer tweets are better.
But don't use 140, because then if somebody tries to retweet or whatever,
And that's the other thing. You know, in this data, I'm using click through rate, which doesn't, like, it's a measurement taken from other forms of online marketing that is a little tricky to apply to Twitter, only because the click through rate can go over 100%. Meaning, if I have 10 followers and I tweet something, and somebody with 1,000 followers retweets it, and it gets 100 clicks, suddenly I have a, you know, whatever that is, 1,000% click through rate, right? So retweets definitely are part of that phenomena.
Yeah, and one of the things I notice on your kind of how to get more click through is this idea, and we've seen this too in MediaShift and on our Twitter feeds, is this idea that, you know, if you post tweets kind of at times where there isn't that much volume, like on the weekends or at night, I notice the afternoon is another big time. For getting click through. So that's something we've noticed too in our statistics, that, you know, you try to post your tweets at a time where there isn't as much competition, I guess.
Yeah, I wrote about this pretty in depth in my book, and it's you can find a few other infographics on my site about it. I call it contra competitive timing, and I find this phenomena in almost every place in online marketing I look, not just social media, not just Twitter, right? So Facebook, you know, the sharing of articles on the weekends increases in Facebook. Emails. I looked at a big data set of emails. Click-through rates tend to be higher on the weekends. Open rates tend to be higher on the weekends. And blogging is a little bit different, but you can see some of the same things. The weekends aren't as great in blogging, but earlier in the day can be helpful in blogging as well. And then retweets, again, retweets peak on Fridays. I think there is so much noise, there is so much happening in social media. The traditional advertising cliche is to cut through the clutter, meaning to, you know, yell over the top of the noise. Whereas I think it works a little bit better just to, you know, wait till everybody else is a little more quiet.
So what would you like to study more? What's kind of on your plate for, like, the future?
So in the immediate future, I have, I'm working on some research about ebooks, actually. And what consumers want as far as ebooks go, things like that. I'm also redoing a lot of my Twitter statistics. The ones you saw in that infographic, a lot of them are very new. I began my Twitter research 4 or 5 years ago. Some of it is a little, I don't want to say outdated, but it's definitely a little bit older now. So I'm redoing a lot of that soon. And I'm also working on a way to measure or to test for social media success of content ahead of time. Because you can't A-B test content for social media. You can't, you know, take two articles and see which one gets more retweets and then roll with that one. Like, it doesn't work like that, like it does in other forms of online marketing. So I'm working on some ways to be able to kind of pre-test, say, headlines and pieces of content for social media success.
Oh, that's cool. It sounds great. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So next, let's talk about the East Coast versus West Coast in media tech. Dorian, you kind of have been following this in New York. You're in New York. I'm in San Francisco. You know, the West Coast, and especially the Bay Area, has been known as kind of the tech hub with the history of Silicon Valley and everything that's gone on here. But as far as media technology, I mean, New York is the media capital and has always been kind of the U.S. media capital. And, you know, it's gone through its own phases of Silicon Alley, you know, having all these technology startups and stuff. You know, where does it stand right now in New York as far as media technology and just technology startup scene?
Well, it's definitely coming up. I mean, both anecdotally and in terms of data, you can see it. I have to say that it's kind of a weird position to see New York this way, because, you know, New York often thinks of itself as the center of the universe and acts like the center of the universe, and they have a lot of the most prominent things in the country or the world, you know, publishing industry, dance, theater, finance. And so it's a little funny to see New York being a little whiny and saying, you know, no, but we're really good too. You know, we're just...
So it's not usually in your character.
No. I mean, I'm a born and bred New Yorker, but not a dyed in the wool, because I lived a lot of other places, and I can sort of look at it with a bit of a distant eye now. But it's not in the New Yorker character, but there was a little bit of that for a long time. You know, there was the Silicon Alley, which is not too far from where I am, in sort of the 20s and Broadway, where this little high-tech community got started and then kind of faded away with the dot-com bust. But the Bay Area just continued to roll on, and the huge, well-known tech venture capital firms, or, you know, the word for them is Sand Hill Road, which of course is near Palo Alto and Menlo Park, and so that's really the high-tech center. But what's happened is that New York has both, by virtue of the fact that it has a lot of smart people in finance and media people, and through efforts of venture capitalists like Fred Wilson and angel funders, David Rose and other people, begun to pick up. And we've seen some big tech companies start to come out of here, like Tumblr and like Foursquare. And of course, Google has huge headquarters, not headquarters, but a huge office here in New York now. And, you know, we're starting to see, and, you know, Fred Wilson said about a year ago that it used to be that New York had 1/8 the number of venture deals in tech as the Bay Area, and now it has 3/8. So proportionally, it's gotten bigger. And the city is trying, you know, Mayor Bloomberg, of course, the Bloomberg of Bloomberg News, that Bloomberg is now our mayor, and he made a huge amount of money doing information technology through Bloomberg terminals and all those spin-offs. And he, under his leadership, the city has tried to become even more of a tech hub, launched a big competition, and a bunch of universities, including Stanford from the Bay Area, a bid to build this new tech center. And it turned out that Cornell, which is based in upstate New York, is going to get something like $100 million to build a tech campus on Roosevelt Island, which is this island where you can take a tram from Manhattan or a subway. It's between Manhattan and Queens. And, there's an old hospital that used to be an asylum there, and I guess that's sort of being retired, and they're going to build a big high-tech campus there now, try to spur all kinds of new venture industry and things like that.
And they really want to make it this kind of science center, you know, to teach. I guess part of it will be teaching kind of college-age students more science and technology. And also there's a whole kind of incubator part of it where they're going to try to get they're actually setting up a venture fund that will go along with this, that will try to, and I think the requirement of getting the venture money is that you have to keep your company in New York for at least 3 years.
Yeah, they're going to try to create jobs, they're going to try to create education, and they're going to do, it's going to be a public-private consortium. The city is going to seed it, but they're also going to look for matching funding. So it is this whole big initiative. And then another initiative is something called the Media Lab. And I don't know tons of details about it, but I know that the city launched an RFP, a request for proposal, for people to bid to become the lead consultant, really the project lead, on building a Media Lab, which is a second project the city's going to fund to help spur development of media in New York City. Obviously not the traditional media that's already so ensconced here, but more digital media and help attract more of those kinds of people and create jobs and information and those kinds of things as well.
Yeah, and it was fascinating to see that kind of real estate report, which just, you know, gets down to the brass tacks and says, you know, the finance sector will lose, you know, 10,000 jobs, while the media and technology sector is going to add 20,000 jobs this year in 2012. That's pretty fascinating to see that.
Yeah, the New York City Comptroller late last year came out with a report that said finance sector is losing a whole bunch of jobs. And then Cresa Partners, a real estate firm, basically commercial real estate firm in New York, came out with this report that said exactly what you did, which, you know, you can measure a lot of where business is going by seeing where office space is going. And, you know, they say the people renting and buying office space in New York now are media firms and tech firms, and that's where the job growth is. And, you know, so this trend of New York becoming more prominent should only continue this year.
Yeah, and as a kind of a footnote, I mean, they noticed that the office space is definitely changing when it's between finance and this kind of media and technology startups, where there's more open space, there's less corner offices, there's kind of more of the kind of what you see in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I think the zeitgeist is changing a bit too. In fact, I kind of got, not figuratively slapped in the face at a conference because I was talking to somebody who I believe is from Techstars, which is another sort of incubator, startup incubator in New York. They have a competition where hundreds of people compete to get seed funding, and 10 are selected and then incubated for a few months, and then they do another round. And so this guy from Techstars, I said, there's, I think, having gone to Stanford and lived on the West Coast, I'm married to a woman who went to Berkeley, so I have definitely a foot in both places. And I always thought the mentality in the Bay Area was kind of more open-minded, experimental, risk-taking. And he pretty much said, oh, you're so 2008 or whatever. He basically told me to shut the hell up, and New York was so much better now. And, like, New Yorkers are risk-takers. And then listed all these facts and factoids, some of the ones I've said to you about Tumblr and Foursquare and all these other things that are starting up here.
Yeah, so there's a lot to give New York its props for. I mean, now you've got like the Giants in the Super Bowl, and they beat the 49ers.
Well,
So there's a lot of bragging rights going on for New York right now.
As a Stanford alum, whose coach is teaching the 40, not coaching the 49ers, and an old 49ers fan, I did have mixed feelings about that one, although I'm happy the Giants are in it. I mean, let's be serious though too. It's not as if the Bay Area is going away, and it still does dwarf New York and Boston, which is actually number two in venture financing behind the Bay Area. And I'm not sure, but I believe if you combine Boston and New York venture financing, you still have less than what there is in the Bay Area. Yes, New York is coming up. I'm here. It is getting more prominence. I think that means that, if this is the commercial hub of the U.S., more attention's focused, that means the economy is probably going more that way. But, the Bay Area is still far and above the 800-pound gorilla of high tech.
Right. And when, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook at Harvard, it didn't take him long to move that out to Palo Alto.
Good point. Good point. And I suppose somebody who's in New York, trying to wave the flag for New York would say, well, today he could move to New York and do just as well. But we'll see about that.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with my co-host Dorian Benkoil. I'd like to thank our guest, Dan Zarella, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check up on all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.